Washington Post Live's This is Climate Tipping Point Summit is presented by 3M and Ecolab.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
I'm Juliet Eilprin, Deputy Climate and Environment Editor here at the Washington Post. I'm pleased to be joined by John Podesta, who is Senior Advisor to the President for International Climate Policy, a role he took on in January of this year. He's also overseeing implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden's signature climate bill. John Podesta, welcome to the Washington Post.
Good to be with you, Juliet. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. You added a new role to your portfolio and replaced John Kerry, who was U.S. Climate Envoy at the end of January, as if overseeing the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act wasn't enough, and the hundreds of billions of dollars that are attached to it. So briefly, if you could give us a sense of what your conversation was like with President Biden about this new role, and what are your top priorities?
Well, look, no one can really replace Secretary Kerry. He did just an amazing job. And I think the president, in both re-entering Paris, showing that he was prepared to make a commitment to cut emissions in half by 2030 on behalf of the United States, and then appointing Special Envoy Kerry to that role, sent a powerful signal that we were going to be leaders again in this fight globally to tackle the climate crisis. And the secretary did an amazing job. You know, I joke that I now have two full-time jobs, yes. But I'm continuing to oversee the Inflation Reduction Act implementation. I think that's going really well. We're seeing private sector investment boosted all around the country, which is what the president intended. But there's also a significant role in the international sphere to keep ambition high, to move forward, particularly this year is sometimes referred to as the finance COP, because we need to work through how we're going to increase the availability of finance, particularly for the least developed countries, to be able to create sustainable patterns of development based on clean energy resources rather than dirty fossil fuels. So that's a big task, and there's a terrific team at the State Department that Secretary Kerry assembled, and I'm still at the White House, but coordinating with them in these international negotiations. There's also just a lot. The Japanese Prime Minister met with the President yesterday. He's here with the President of the Philippines today. So there's a lot of work to be done at the bilateral level as well. For example, we just significantly created a ministerial level dialogue between the Japanese so-called GX program, which is a little bit modeled after the IRA. I think, it's sort of a form of flattery that countries around the world are saying this investment-led strategy is important. And so the Minister of METI and I started a dialogue on how we can coordinate the development of the push towards innovation that's going to be necessary to meet our goals by, it's an audacious effort to try to get to net zero by 2050, as you well know.
Right. And one question about just, right, this push of different countries, including the United States, in terms of investing in clean energy here. I'm curious to know if and when the priorities of the agendas of your two roles to some extent come into conflict. For example, European leaders have criticized the Buy American provisions within the IRA. French President Emmanuel Macron said that the IRA might fragment the West and declared a need for, like, for example, a more made in Europe strategy. And to what extent has the IRA made global cooperation, which is obviously essential to addressing global climate change, harder and diverted money more, potentially equally importantly or even more important, that could have gone to the global south, which obviously needs to push in terms of decarbonization?
Well, look, we got to do both things. We got to transition the U.S. economy towards one that's built on clean energy. Mm-hmm. Later today, jump it a little bit,
yep.
We'll announce that we've permitted 25 gigawatts of renewable energy on public lands. I mean, the whole of government effort here to reduce emissions, to move towards clean energy, to build out the electrification of heating and cooling. There's just a lot of moving parts in that. And we need to do that. And I think that, quite frankly, at least when they close the door and talk to me, leaders around the world respect and admire the fact that the president has become such a leader and so ambitious in trying to create a investment-led economic strategy that's building the kinds of investments that are going to be critical. So that's job one. Put your money where your mouth is, and get the job done here. Cut emissions here. We're doing that through both through the powers we have to reduce emissions in the transportation, power sector, et cetera. But we're also creating that that virtuous cycle of innovation. On the other hand, we also have to pay attention to what's going on around the world. And the United States is a leader in that regard as well. I think the president went to UNGA in the first year, the UN General Assembly, in the first year that he was elected, and pledged that the United States would try to move $11 billion of financing from direct U.S.-supported financing to this project of trying to deploy clean energy around the world. Mm-hmm. We went from $1.5 billion when he made that announcement to over $9 billion, and we're, I think, on our way to make the commitment of $11 billion worth of funding. Mm-hmm. We've been a leader in trying to reform the international financial institutions to make them fit for purpose at this time when their first mission is, of course, development, but it has to be done in light of what's happening to societies that are being pressed and pressured by the effects of climate change. And I think we have very good, Secretary Yellen's been leader, our Treasury Secretary, on that. We have a very good relationship with our international partners and trying to move that forward. So look, this, as you know, the nation's birthday, July 4th, was the hottest day on record.
Yeah.
July was the hottest month,
right.
Followed by the hottest August, the hottest September. I can go up. You just reported the hottest March on record.
Right.
We have a crisis, and we're seeing it in the effects that are taking place on livelihoods, on food and water systems, on extreme weather, on forest fires, etc. We got to get on with this project, and we have to do that at home, and we have to do it abroad.
Okay, and just one quick question on that, and then we'll move to the domestic front. But last month, the World Meteorological Association found that in 2023, obviously, concentrations of greenhouse gases continued to rise. You know, we had record hot oceans, and that the rate of increase is accelerating. At what point do you think we face the prospect that the Paris Agreement goal of keeping global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius has been breached and we've entered a new era?
Well, look, you know, I mean, I think if you look at what's happening just now and the way the scientists measure this, it's over a longer period of time.
Right.
But if you look at what's happening just now, as the introduction noted and I noted, we're beginning to reach that number as we're sitting here. Now, that's partly the effect of El Nino and other factors. It's likely to probably dip and rise a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's no question that in order to maintain a livable planet, we have to cut emissions, and that is a global challenge. The United States is still the world's largest historic emitter. But China has far surpassed us now. There are almost twice as many emissions in China. And other countries are, engaged in this process, but we have to move forward if we're going to have a livable planet for our children and our grandchildren.
And speaking of China, which has obviously flooded global markets with low-priced goods, whether it's electric vehicles or solar panels, if climate change is this obviously urgent existential threat, as you lay out, why shouldn't the U.S. embrace, for example, cheap solar panels and EVs especially at a time when U.S. adoption of EVs is
Look, launched. we have multiple challenges. Mm-hmm. One is our own economic security. We're way over dependent on Chinese supplies for critical minerals, for batteries, for upstream solar technology. I think the president recognized that. And basically created a strategy through the Inflation Reduction Act to reshore and friendshore those technologies to become less dependent. If you need any example of why this is critical, look at the European dependency on Russian fossil fuels and what the illegal invasion of Ukraine did to those markets and did to the economic security of European nations, to know we cannot be dependent on a single source of supply with a country that's fully prepared to use that as leverage. And by the way, built some of that lead up, if you will, through non-market practices and practices that weren't that were discriminating against against other technologies, other countries, et cetera. So I think our plan is to be ensure that we are secure and to do it in a way that's making massive investment in the U.S. economy. It's probably the strongest part of our economy right now are these investments in these clean technologies. We've seen $383 billion worth of announced investments in batteries, in EVs, in final assembly, in solar, in deploying renewable energy across the country. That's good for the economy, that's good for jobs, that's good for wages, and it's good for the economic security of the United States.
We have a question from the audience from Rebecca Flora from Maryland. She asks, how can we ensure that the growing EV market will not create a whole new set of social and environmental issues associated with mineral extraction, road safety, and maintenance due to heavier vehicles, proper disposal or reclamation of batteries, and a lack of access by lower income populations?
Well, look, I think we're focused on the circular economy. At one level, one of the ways to meet the challenge of critical minerals is to do more effective recycling of existing resources, and that is available, I think, in this space. The batteries can be recycled, etc. We've spent a significant amount of money both demonstrating new technologies through the Department of Energy grant programs and also through the Loan Program Office and providing companies in the United States the ability to stand up recycling operations. So I think it's an important question, but in the end of the day, transportation is now the number one emitter in the United States. We've got to move forward with cleaner forms of transportation, and the fastest way to do that is through electrification. The American public has the choice of deciding what kind of vehicles they want to purchase, but we're seeing rapid adoption of electric vehicles, and that's a good thing for the planet. So one has to do that with care, with the highest standards. That's true in mining, which are, I think we're seeing effort to try to provide assurance and reassurance that mining will be done in an environmentally effective way, but we also need to see those applications happen. So, for example, the Loan Program Office I just mentioned just did a major loan to a lithium extraction company in northern Nevada.
Right.
We need that lithium, and I think it can be done and extracted in an environmentally sensitive way. There are other projects in the Salton Sea and other places that have great promise. But if you pay attention to detail, if you get permitting right, if you do it rapidly, if you let the public participate in that process, you can make good decisions. You could do it. We got just really slow at permitting projects.
Right.
We forgot how to build things in America. We're back to the business of building, and that's good again for our future.
And as charging infrastructure stalls, we have not seen, as you know, rapid deployment of public chargers. States are quick to expand highways, often with federal funds. 20 to 30% of all public highway spending goes to the expansion rather than programs to fix and repair existing roads. How can the administration make sure that the infrastructure bill isn't working against the climate goals of this country?
Well, look, I think we need to ensure that we're, first of all, that we're being sensitive and adapting to the effects of climate. So I think one of the things that's gone into the planning and deployment of those resources is ensuring that we're planning for the future that we're going to have, not the one that we, you know, just lived through. Right. So that, I think that's a very important feature. But I think significant resources are going to building more resilient infrastructure that's doing it at a time when we're also trying to reduce emissions, for example, through reducing emissions from heavy-duty vehicles from at ports and other installations that can be heavily polluting and really are some of the largest sources of environmental injustice in the country because of how much both shipping and trucking goes through those ports. So I think if you do it in a smart way, we can get the balance right. People want to move, they want to be involved in transportation, but we're just going to have to do it in a cleaner way. And whether that's air travel through the use of sustainable aviation fuel, or whether it's ground travel through electrification the plug-in hybrids and other kind of vehicles, we have got to get emissions out of these sectors, and that's a process that will take place over some period of time. But I think the American public, if you look at J.D. Power's other surveys, are really deciding that this is the way to go, and we're seeing the tick up, particularly as the price of electric vehicles comes down, the tick up of public acceptance and the consideration of purchasing an electric vehicle, because it's good for the planet and it's good for the pocketbook. Well, reducing costs overall for American consumers.
Okay, I want to talk about the grid for a minute. An Energy Department study found that the U.S. must double its regional transmission capacity to meet its 2035 clean energy goal.
Yeah, this is a huge challenge.
Yeah, is that possible without permitting reform?
Look, I think we've done everything we can to both implement the modest changes that were made as part of bipartisan legislation that passed last Congress. We've deployed $1 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act to increase both the personnel and the technical capacity of federal agencies to permit. We've put money out to the states to try to improve their permitting processes as a multi-layered process multi-jurisdictional process in the U.S. But we got to get on with it. And those numbers are, not only do we need to double the amount of transmission, we need to cut the time in half on how long it takes to get transmission permitted. Mm-hmm. I think we're doing that with authorities. We'll issue final rules soon, giving the Secretary of Energy more capacity and authority to set hard deadlines for transmission and permitting that was available to us, and we were the first administration to take advantage of that. It was in the Federal Power Act. This is something that occupies. I've been around the track a little bit here.
Yeah.
So first administration I've been in where this is from the president and chief of staff on down, run by our deputy chief of staff, we meet regularly at the cabinet level on permitting on specific projects to break through gridlock and roadblocks. And a lot of things get stuck down in the bowels of agencies, and when the political leadership of those agencies can take a look at them, we can make progress.
Okay, we only have a few more minutes. I need to get through some more questions.
Okay.
So the Post has reported on how the AI boom and the rise in clean tech manufacturing are pushing America's power grid to the BRIC. So should conditions be put on some of these operations, given that they threaten to undermine the U.S. climate goals?
Look, I think, it doesn't seem to me that that's the way to approach this problem. I think AI has significant applications that can help on the climate front. It also has significant concerns, and the president's addressed some of those in terms of privacy and et cetera. But I think that the promise of building this out is generally a good thing for the United States, but we have to have the power resources to do it. That's putting more pressure on utilities to do things like advanced reconductoring of existing power sector lines, to be able to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last fall put some new rules out to deal with the problems of interconnection, of getting renewable resources tied into the grid. That's improved the process there. Other utilities are looking at that around the country. But there's no question we're going to have to build a lot of clean power in the U.S. There's a place, and we're investing in small modular nuclear reactors, so that's been moving forward again. But we need a lot of power. We need it to be clean. We need it to be zero carbon. And we need a lot of transmission capacity to move that power to the applications.
And this, I believe, will be my last question. Obviously, you're dealing with a Republican-controlled House. The Ukraine aid bill is a top priority. Republicans have raised the prospect of lifting the pause on liquefied natural gas exports in order to push that bill through. To what extent is the administration open to that?
Look, I mean, I think we have said now many times in the last several weeks, they should pass the bill. It's got bipartisan support. I think clearly there are votes in the House to pass the bill, the bipartisan bill that passed the Senate, and they should do it and do it quickly and promptly and not lard it up with other issues. With respect to the pause, that's smart policy. We stand behind it. We've now the largest exporter of natural gas. We're building twice the capacity we currently have. What we're doing and Secretary of Energy is doing is looking at the economics and environmental aspects of going further, and we're going to stick with that.
Okay, in like 15 seconds, you've made a hallmark of your career protecting open public spaces in the United States. To what extent can we expect the president to use his authority to do more conservation?
Oh, I think you'll see some more, Juliet. You know, the president's pledged to protect 30% of lands and waters in the United States. We're on track. He's been an amazing president in the first term. I worked for President Clinton, for President Obama. They both had tremendous conservation records. President Biden is just surpassing that in terms of what he's able to do in the first term. And I think we've got more to come, including better use and better protection of public lands, getting the balance right between being able to deploy renewable energy on public lands. You'll see more about that today, and conserving public lands. But yeah, I think we have a few more coming.
Okay.
And pretty soon.
We will continue to follow this important story. Unfortunately, we're out of time. John Podesta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
today.
For
the following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
Hello. So environmental, social, and governance initiatives known as ESGs were so popular with companies just a short time ago as a way to address climate change. But they've become controversial, and the business case for them has been questioned. So here with us today to discuss is Tiffany Atwell. Tiffany is Senior Vice President of Global Governance at Ecolab. Ecolab is a leader in addressing the world's water crisis. It helps businesses use less water and recycle it and reuse it. So thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, happy to be here with you today.
So as mentioned, in many quarters, ESG has fallen out of favor, portrayed as conflicting with profitability and with shareholder value. Why would you say that portrayal of ESGs is perhaps a bit misleading?
Great question. I think it's misleading because what we've seen with many of our customers that we serve, they are still working and driving ESG initiatives. They may call it something different, but ESG and sustainability leads to profitability. So we know this through the work with our customers, and we're working with customers across 40 industries, across 170 countries. The other piece of this is Ecolab's founding. We were founded 100 years ago, and we were founded on being more sustainable for our customers. And that sustainability mission came about and has grown even before ESG was hip. And so while I think that we are seeing a camp of people who are saying they're anti-ESG, I think that that is part of the puzzle. But I think the other piece of what we're seeing is people don't understand that sustainability actually means you're going to be more profitable. There have been several studies that have come out. McKinsey has done a study. Drucker Institute has done a study that show, Drucker Institute shows that of the 250 most profitable companies that are run the best, managed well, they are doing ESG initiatives today. And so I think that this is, you know, some of what we're seeing, and there's a silver lining there that I'm hoping that today's discussion can help debunk.
So you are saying that companies can meet their 2030 climate goals and actually improve their profitability at the same time?
Absolutely. And we're doing it every day. So we're not just saying, let's do it for our customers. Ecolab is doing it. We actually have a plan to work to save enough drinking water by 2030 that will help 1 billion people have access to clean drinking water. And that's important because of all of the beautiful people in this room, you've never had to go to your tap and turn it on and not have access to water. But of course, we know that not just in India and other developing countries, there are people in the United States of America who do not have access to drinking water. So our mission, while we must make sure that our companies are profitable, our mission is also because we know that we can make the world a better place by doing what we're doing, and everyone has a role to play. And the other piece of our sustainability goals that's really exciting for me and our goals for 2030 is our reduction of greenhouse gases. We know that there's an interconnectedness between water, it's a tool, as well as it's a victim to climate change. Saving and reusing and recycling water, and this is what we plan to do, it will help us reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 6 million metric tons by 2030.
Give us a snapshot right now. Would you say that companies are on track to meet their 2030 climate goals? And if they're not, if they're lagging, why is that the case?
I think many are, just because I know our customers. When I think about Cargill and Kraft Heinz, who are big customers of ours, I know that they're on track. I mean, but of course, not every company is our customer, and different people have different views on what they should be doing. I think the people that are lagging, because there are people that are lagging, it's because they don't understand that sustainability actually leads to more profitability, and that's where we need to educate, and we also need to have other NGOs and partners from the government to help people understand this, but also ensure that there are the resources there to ensure that they can actually take under some of these improvements to their manufacturing sites.
Are you seeing a public response to the fact that some companies are not on track?
Absolutely. We actually consulted a global consumer study last year with Morning Consult. And consumers care about these issues. And so this is another reason companies should care. What we found is 80% of the consumers in the United States expect for governments and private sector to work on water conservation issues. And so that's 80% of consumers. Baby boomers really are concerned about water conservation and having access to water. And so that figure was also also 80%, millennials in the 70 percentile. So consumers are making decisions, buying choices based on companies' sustainability practices. And so if government policy is not enough and being more profitable is not enough, understanding that your customers care about these issues, I'm hoping that that will help them understand that they need to get on board with this.
Are there things that the public sector can do to nudge companies in the right direction?
Well, I think we're seeing it. It comes with, you know, it comes with the decisions that they're making about who they're supporting. And I, of course, there could be more. But I would say when you think about what this administration has done, but it's not just this administration. If you go around the world, you'll see that in Europe, you know, and many other countries, even in China these days, you know, there's a push on these issues. So I don't think it's dead, even if it's unpopular and people aren't talking about it in a very positive way, the way we've previously seen.
Can you give us some examples of successful public-private collaboration in this area?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, our last speaker spoke to this to a certain degree. Trying to solve these issues, whether it's climate change and using water as a tool to fight climate change, is something that has to be done, not just with companies. I'm very proud to have a CEO who wants to work with other like-minded companies. We've joined the Water Resilience Coalition that works through the UN Global Compact. And so you have, you know, you have the UN, you have, of course, us, and you have other NGOs, water.org and Pacific Institute, that are working globally to recapture water basins. And the plan is to recapture and renew 100 water basins across the world by 2030. And that is not just a commitment of resources, know-how, personally, of what companies will do, but it's also the work of these NGOs who have a lot of expertise and who can help us bring in the community so they can be a part of driving this solution. And so I think water is complicated. It's not sexy, per se. And so with this complexity, it's worth it to bring in all of these other stakeholders, which is what we've done through my CEO, Christoph Beck's leadership, to try to actually make some changes here and get results.
So let's talk about Ecolab's own operations.
Yes.
What are you doing internally to drive more sustainable outcomes in your operations?
That great question. Well, I think that there are many things that I could talk about, but of course we're using the same technology that we use for our customers to help them reuse and recycle their water. We're using that in our own operations. We just committed to put all of our fleet in California to EVs, to switch over to EVs. Our operations in Europe now will be run off of a wind farm out of Finland. And so we'll be completely off the grid. And so our plan is not just to try to consult for our customers so that they can do sustainability the right way and then be profitable, but it's also driving our growth. And so we have amazing scientists and engineers that are working on these issues every day so we can be stronger and a better example.
So how do you help your customers? What tools do you give them to do what you're doing?
Well, we use AI. We use digital solutions. So we literally go in and we do an audit, and our customers are like our family, and we look at what they're doing great and how they can improve and how they're trying to grow. And we're trying to get them to grow using less resources, whether it's water and everything else. And so we do that audit, and then we go to them and say, this is how you can improve. We're going to hold your hand, and we're going to help you meet these milestones. But we're doing this using digital solutions. We have something called 3D Tracer, which actually helps digitally capture the movement of water, what's needed as far as treatment of water. And all of this is done remotely. And so we take out the human component, but it helps them be better at what they're doing. doing, and we offer other types of solutions, even if they're not ours, to make sure that they can meet their sustainability goals, but also be more profitable.
So AI, a valuable tool for you.
Absolutely, and I know you're an expert on AI, so.
I don't know if I'm an expert, but I'm certainly intrigued by it. So here we have this terrific audience here of a couple of hundred people. If there's one thing you would like them to walk out of this room with, what would it be?
I would say you do not have to sacrifice profitability and being a successful business by trying to meet your sustainability goals. I know that there's been a lot of negativity around ESG, but you don't have to make that choice. And then you get to actually make more money, be more successful, but leave the world in a much better place. I think we all probably have loved ones or someone that's not here with us today, younger or older, and we can actually make a difference. And that's why I'm so proud to work for Ecolab, because every day I get to think about how we can make the world a better place, but at the same time making sure that our customers are more successful. So that would be my takeaway.
Wonderful. Tiffany Atwell, Senior Vice President of Global Government Relations at Ecolab. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Today.
Pleasure's mine.
And now we are going to hand things back to the Washington Post.
And now, back to Washington Post Live.
Good morning. I'm David J. Lynch, the Post's Global Economics Correspondent, and I have the pleasure of being joined today from Geneva by the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. Director General, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Nice to see you too.
Welcome to the show. So let's get right to it. How can trade policy help us meet our climate goals, the goals that we're doing a fairly poor job of meeting so far?
Well, thank you, David, for that question. I've always maintained that trade is part of the solution to getting to net zero by 2050. People always see trade as part of the problem, but it's actually part of the solution. And to that effect, for COP28, we developed a kind of toolkit at the WTO Secretariat, set of policies or actions that members, countries can take on the trade side, if they want to try to lower carbon emissions. I'll just mention two or three, just as an example, so we are very specific. If you look at the import tariff regimes of many countries, you'll often find that you have lower tariffs on internal combustion engines than on electric vehicles, when it should be the other way around, in order to incentivize and lower the cost of electric vehicles. So one of the things, this is just an example, we say, look at your import regime to make sure you're not incentivizing things that are actually adding to carbon emissions. And in many developing countries, they import secondhand cars that have even more emissions than new cars. So that's one quick action that you can take. Review your import tariff regime for renewables and cars to make sure that they're well aligned with the net zero by 2050. I think the second is looking at government procurement. We have a government procurement agreement here, and many people may not know, but government spend about $13 trillion on public procurement annually. And this is about 13% of global GDP. And all this procurement contributes about 15% to emissions worldwide, to greenhouse gas emissions. So just think about it. If you can use that power of procurement to purchase green, it could actually drive a decarbonization of the economy. So that's another type of action that governments can take. And then the last one I want to mention, the last example is repurposing harmful subsidies. We say we want to move to net zero, but we have a lot of subsidies in the world that are actually incentivizing greenhouse gas emissions or other types of actions that are not really helping to decarbonizing our environment. We have almost $2 trillion in these kinds of subsidies. Agriculture, $640 billion in subsidies that are trade distorting. are not really helpful to agricultural trade. We have fossil fuel subsidies, depending on the estimate, sometimes direct subsidies of $1.2 trillion. And we have harmful fisheries subsidies that we're working on here at the WTO to remove of about $22 billion. So if you keep totaling subsidies, you can get up to $2 trillion. So we're saying, why are we incentivizing the wrong thing? Why don't we up these subsidies so that they can help us?
Right. On your point about the tariff structure effectively discouraging the adoption of renewables, we seem to be on the verge of perhaps moving in the wrong direction, given concern in the U.S. and Europe about a potential flood of low-cost, subsidized Chinese green energy products, solar panels, electric vehicles, et cetera. Is it your position that U.S. and European leaders should keep tariffs low and accept these Chinese products, even at the cost of their own domestic industries and hopes to grow jobs in these sectors?
That's a very tricky one, David. Of course, you would throw such a tricky question.
Thank you. My work here is
I think that the U.S. and you have concerns that perhaps the goods are coming in at a cheaper cost, the market jobs are being taken away. You know, normally you would say yes, if we are to adopt kinds of new technologies, we want to get them at as low a cost as can enable consumers to buy them. But I think there are two different concerns. The concern about protecting jobs, rightly or wrong, but the concern is there. I think that's what's driving the U.S. and position, that they also want to manufacture cars. So we have to balance. We want to make sure we don't encourage adoption of these new technologies so that we can get net zero faster. But at the same time, balancing it with the concerns we spoke about. And it's also something we should pay attention to. Let me leave it at that.
And how about the climate impact of trade itself, the physical movement of goods, trillions of dollars of goods moving all over the world from Asia to the United States to Europe, et cetera? Are the maritime fleets, railroads, the trucks themselves doing enough to decarbonize?
Well, that's the part of trade that that many focus on. And actually, I'm quite encouraged by what is going on. If you look at the shipping industry, the aviation industry, the trucking industry, everyone is looking for how they can decarbonize, lower greenhouse gas emissions. So new technologies are coming up all the time. The ships that are looking at green hydrogen and how to use that to repower ships, aviation industry has alternatives. So I'm very excited at what is going on and how these industries are trying to change the way that they could from one part of the world to another. So I think we will come up with solutions to those problems.
And you and other global leaders, the head of the IMF, for instance, have warned about the dangers of fragmentation of the global economy and the global trading system. And I think you've said that we can't achieve our climate goals if that fragmentation is allowed to happen, the division of the world into sort of competing trade and economic spheres. Do you have the political support that you need from the Biden administration at the WTO to continue to do what you can to prevent that fragmentation? Has the Biden administration been any more supportive of your organization than its predecessor?
What I can tell you is that we have a very constructive dialogue with the Biden administration and with the USTR, and that certain reforms that we're trying to carry out at the WTO supportive of that. Let me put it this way. We have a positive dialogue with them, and we'd like to make sure that their concerns, as well as being listened to, as well as the concerns of other WTO members. But yes, We are working constructively.
How do you assess the current state of the fragmentation issue? Do you feel like we're at the point where some split in the global economy is baked in, given the trends in U.S.-Chinese relations? Or do you feel like over the last year or so, the world has made progress in preventing that?
I think we are seeing signs of increasing fragmentation in the world economy. And we, 2 years ago, we actually began to point that out. We did some work here to show that if the world were to decouple into two trading blocks, we would lead to a loss of global GDP of about 5% in the longer term. That's a big loss. And the IMF and others have done subsequent work that also points in the same direction, sometimes with slightly larger numbers. And since we did that work, we are seeing emerging signs of fragmentation. We don't see any big signs of decoupling yet in the economy, but there are emerging signs of fragmentation. We looked at simulations looking at two blocks of like-minded countries, trading within those blocks as well as across the block. And in the past, we saw that the growth of trade across these two blocks was about the same as within the block. But now we are seeing people trading more with like-minded countries than they are trading across those not so politically like themselves. So this is some emerging concern that like-minded trading is going on much more than we saw in the past. We also see in certain sectors like semiconductors, the tech industry, of course, emerging signs of fragmentation because of some of the measures that are being put by countries, the US certainly, China itself, and others. So we are beginning to see some difference there in terms of the smooth flow of trade across. So yes, to your question, the answer, we are beginning to see emerging signs of fragmentation in the world. And that concerns us, because I think for the rest of the world, I've given you one number, if we begin to fragment, it will be costly globally for all countries, both large and small, rich and poor. I'll just give you one more example of fragmentation. We normally look at what is happening with global value chains and, this, and the trade in intermediate goods. That is those goods that are used to manufacture other goods. And we've seen in this year of 2023, a 6% decline in global trade of non-fuel intermediate goods. And this just indicates a contraction in global value chain. So that's another sign that something is happening with respect to fragmentation that we need to watch. So grosso modo, no huge sign of decoupling, but emerging signs of fragmentation that we need to watch.
Let's talk about developing countries for a moment, who obviously want to exploit their fossil fuel resources to try and grow their economies, give their peoples a better life. Should they be asked to prioritize the climate fight instead? And if so, what are the prospects for such countries getting the financial assistance that they require, with interest rates being as high as they are?
Well, David, I think that given the temperature rises we are seeing in the world, every country should be concerned about how to lower greenhouse gas emissions and how to get to net zero by 2050. But I think it's a question of pace. As you know, developing countries feel that they didn't contribute to the present situation we're in, and they contribute much less to greenhouse gas emissions. Africa, for example, contributes 3% or less to global greenhouse gas emissions. And historically, they've not been the ones contributing. So they feel that they also need to be given the policy space to be able to develop their population and improve income. So what does all that spell? We, at the Paris Agreement, it was there was a built-in recognition that developing countries should be common but differentiated responsibility, meaning that developing countries would also need the time to adjust. And so what we see is a situation in which, yes, developing countries should contribute, but they should be given more time to do so. And you will note that some of them have said, look, we cannot reach net zero by 2050, but maybe it's 2060 or 2070. So that a just transition. So one, time to adjust. They can't phase out of fossil fuels immediately. They need time to do that, but they need to move in the right direction. Maybe gas as a transition fuel for many of them. Two, they need the money and the technology to adjust. So one, where we have these green technologies, the free flow of technologies and trade really does enable the flow of technologies at scale. So that's why we need fair, open, and predictable trade underpinned by the WTO. We need that. We need transfer of technology, so IP issues and how we share technology is important. And then lastly, finance. They need financing to be able to adjust. And that's where the world has not really come up with the promises it made. $100 billion was promised per year to developing countries to help with this. It's been very difficult to come up with that. I think the developed countries are just about there now. But if you think about the fact that Africa will need $2.8 trillion by 2030 to be able to adjust, that's a lot of money. So how to get this financing is very important. How to account for loss and damage when events take place and where that money will come from is very important. Some progress was made at COP28, but more is needed.
We have less than 2 minutes left, but I do want to go to a question that we've received from an audience member. Cheryl Fernandez asks, what actions can be taken today to address global displacement resulting from climate change? And are there any venues that are particularly promising for holding these discussions? I would just add, how might an increase in the flow of so-called climate refugees affect coastal megacities like Lagos?
I think that's a very thoughtful question. And I think is one that is not really being discussed adequately in the world. And we need to find fora to do that, because we have to contend that this is going to be the case, that we will see climate displacement. We're already seeing it actually within the African continent from the Sahel. As conditions get very difficult, people do migrate south with their animals. We've seen it in Sudan and we've seen it in other places. Both climate change and conflict together are resulting in a lot of migration. But the world has not yet come up with an answer. I think it's a problem that we all need to confront together and to try to be very thoughtful about solutions that could work. How do we invest in developing countries such that when they have this kind of climate event, they'll be able to absorb their population in another part of the country and don't have to migrate elsewhere? But when they do have to migrate, how do we handle that? The world has not really had that kind of conversation, and I think we need to do that.
Well, a sobering thought to end on. I'm afraid we are out of time. Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.